G'day, I'm Rowan Mackey, and I'm joined by my dad, clinical psychologist Chris Mackey, and this is Psych Spiels and Silver Linings. G'day, Dad. How are you going today?
Good, thanks, Rowan. Good to be with you again.
Good to be with you again on the podcast for a new topic. After our few episodes that we did on meaning, we thought we'd mix it up a little bit today, although I think as we've had a little bit of a discussion about this, meaning might come into it in a very maybe small indirect way. So it's always prevalent, I feel, meaning in topics of psychology. But we've called today's episode Making Therapy More Flexible. So, Dad, what are we going to be talking about today?
Okay, well, as we mentioned in the last podcast, I'd recently been to a conference of clinical psychologists across Australia, conference held in Adelaide, and there was a particular workshop session that came across to me as interesting, over and above many of the other things, because I thought it was very interesting how it was presented by a number of people working in an academic setting, like they were working in universities and teaching students coming through how to be the next group of clinical psychologists. And I thought it was particularly interesting because what they were talking about, a way of going about assessing and helping clients in therapy, is more similar to what therapists actually do, I think. Because often the way you see things taught in workshops or in formal training makes it look a lot neater than things actually are. Therapy often includes a working through of things in almost a slightly muddling along way, taking lots of different things into account, adapting or adjusting the therapy according to circumstances. It's not so precise and neat as would be written up. And I thought that this workshop was very good at encouraging more flexible ways of, well, I suppose, understanding people as well as helping people and offering therapy interventions that could bring more creativity into the mix and also really help for having a collaborative relationship between the therapist and the client. So it draws more on the client's feedback and ideas with things as well, I believe.
And it's the sort of thing as well, like, oh, I think this is maybe a trend that's happening in a lot of areas, really. Like you see it in, for example, sports coaching, where there's a more of an emphasis on being collaborative and not necessarily, you know, the whole kind of my way or the highway approach and, you know, I know the way of doing things. Like that kind of way of thinking is a little bit outdated in many ways just because, well, it doesn't necessarily resonate with a lot of people. A lot of people would sort of, I suppose, get more out of a more collaborative arrangement. And it's interesting, even as we sit here on the table near us, so happens to be the room that we often have lunch in here at the practice. And there's a DSM-5 sitting on the table behind us. And it's just interesting as someone who's maybe not trained in psychology, you have a little bit of a look through the DSM-5 and these things come across as so neat, as you say, in that book. And I just found it interesting to look and see that more than half of all people, according to research, who have a mental health condition will actually have more than one mental health condition at a time. There'll be comorbidities and I believe, you know, more than a third of people who have a mental health condition will have more than two comorbidities at a time. So it suggests that it's not as if these things kind of have a nice neat box around it. And it's not as if we can be as prescriptive as, you know, someone coming in and saying, oh, these are my issues. And then the therapist can say, oh, you know, do these three things that are tried and true for absolutely everyone. Like these things are a little bit more fluid, a little bit more individual. And it seems to me that that's in many ways what this presentation that you saw at the conference was getting at, was how to be a little bit more collaborative, a little bit more flexible, how to give the client a little bit more input into their own therapy in a way that's maybe going to help things resonate for them. So it seems to me that psychology is moving in a way that, well, education, you know, sports coaching, like a lot of fields and industries are moving towards this more collaborative model, and this seems to get at a little bit of how that can come into psychology.
Well, it is important that psychological therapy approaches become more flexible because traditionally they were based quite strongly on a medical model. So clinical psychologists would be taught to diagnose using the DSM, and it's a manual that follows a psychiatry-based approach where the notion was if you could identify particular symptoms that added to a particular condition, it might be a panic disorder or depression Or there'd be other even more complex patterns, like certain personality patterns. You could say borderline personality disorder or other conditions, often thought of in terms of conditions, which is as though people had some kind of disease or illness process going on. Now, that disease model works very well in medical circumstances where you're looking to address diabetes or cancer or something like that, and you look at the treatments, the interventions that can address it. But mental health problems don't work like that. It's more messy. It's more about challenges in someone's life. Like, for example, if people are going through grief, they've lost a loved one, it's natural that's going to be impacting on people's sleep or concentration. But should that be seen as some kind of symptom-based illness or disease as opposed to a normal process that people go through if they're adjusting to the loss of a loved one? So there's not this neat overlap between identifying physical health problems and then considering mental health problems as though it should work the same way, where you start with a diagnosis and then you look at a treatment that goes with it. But there were advances, especially in clinical psychology, looking at, say, advances in depression or eating disorders, saying, yes, this person has bulimia or anorexia, and these are some of the cognitive behavioural interventions that might help address that. There are advances that came with that. There were advances that came with identifying this person is suffering from a major depressive disorder. That means that we might look to cognitive therapy methods of addressing their negative thinking, maybe looking at behavioural strategies for increasing people's activity levels that could make a difference. Now, these things are relevant, but also it became a bit overly prescriptive, as though, well, if this person has depression, then they should be given CBT that looks at this, that, and something else. But maybe the person would have been better off addressing some of their early financial problems, or maybe they needed to get more social support in a certain area, or maybe they had overlapping mental health problems that were complicating their first reactions, or maybe they had certain personality difficulties that were getting in the way that weren't part of the symptom picture of depression or anxiety. In other words, it's a lot more messy and complicated than, say, a medical model would look. And also, we know from, say, treatments for mental health problems, that it's not going to be straightforward, that just by giving someone a pill, that's going to, it's certainly not going to be a cure, but it's not going to address a whole lot of the complications that people are dealing with. So when we look at mental health and issues to do with mental health, we need to look at it more flexibly, the range of problems that people might have in their social world. We do consider their biology. There will be things that influence people's temperament and makeup that partly have a genetic influence. But there are also going to be patterns of thinking that make a difference. There's going to be aspects of people's culture that impacts on them in different ways, what resources they have available to them as well. So we need to look at things in a more multimodal way. And it's clear that when you get lots of different schools of therapy saying you should address this problem like this, another school of therapy is quite different, like psychodynamic therapy can be quite different from cognitive behavioural therapy, quite different from psychodrama. And they might say, oh, you should go about problems and addressing them in this way, when they're all quite different, but many different approaches have similar kind of outcomes. Now, how do we make sense of that? It's obviously a more complex pattern than it looked. And what we do know is when studies look to separate out how much of people's recovery or improvement is to do with the clinical approach used itself, for example, the therapy approach itself, or how much is to do, for example, with the relationship between the therapist and the client, we find the relationship factors are more important. So maybe the particular therapy approaches we use, they're helpful for getting a start, they're helping for giving some guidance. And we'll talk about some examples later where certain interventions that therapists introduce, we know they're worth looking at maybe early on compared to other kind of interventions, but there's not this neat match as there is in, say, physical health and treatment for diabetes, say, or other conditions. There's not this neat match between here are your symptoms, this is the intervention that should be used, and we're looking to be more flexible about that.
Well, I suppose just by maybe way of example of that, like I think depression is a pretty good example, because like how many diagnoses from the DSM-5, for example, would have depression almost like as part of it? Like there'd be comorbidities, I believe you call them. But like you mentioned grief, like how often would situations of grief naturally in some ways lead to depression, and say, you know, something like anger issues. Like, you know, if you have anger issues for a little while, potentially there's going to be maybe some changes that happen in your life in terms of how you're treated by friends and all this sort of stuff. You could become a little bit more isolated. Therefore, you're more likely to feel depressed in certain ways. Like, you can easily see how maybe mental health conditions kind of fit together in a particular way. And I think if you look at things in isolation, for example, looking at, say, depressive symptoms, how can we reduce those? It doesn't necessarily get to the heart of what someone's particular issue is in a situation, because, well, at the end of the day, the depression might almost be the, for lack of a better term, the cherry on top, in terms of there's maybe a lot more going on underneath that probably requires a little bit more kind of thought and attention. And the complexity of the mind really just suggests to me that, well, it's not going to be as simple as, you know, reading a book and kind of finding a table and sort of going across, okay, depression, what's the cure? Like, let's just be prescriptive about it. Like, you need some real collaboration with the therapist in order for them to even identify and almost calibrate therapy towards who you are as a person. Like, it seems to me that that's part of what this process is about, is calibrating therapy as much as possible for that particular person to almost find a most efficient and effective way of addressing all of their issues at once, rather than just kind of looking at, you know, what comes to the surface, and then it's almost a game of whack-a-mole of, you know, these are the symptoms that are might be appearing most, but maybe not necessarily the real crux of the issue.
Yes, that's a very good point. Just taking something like depression, we're going to respond very differently, and clearly would need to, if someone comes in and they've recently lost their job, compared to someone who's never made any friends and been more socially isolated. Or otherwise, it might be a person who was functioning very, very well for years and years and years, but then they had extra work demands building up for quite a period of time, and then gradually they're becoming more tired and not sleeping as well, and eventually that unfolds into a depression. Or it might be someone who's reached midlife years, or say around 40 years of age, early 40s, and they're really questioning their life direction in certain ways and whether they're living their life the right way, because they don't find so much joy or meaning in things they do. All of these people might present with depression, but there's so many different patterns to it. Each of those examples suggests the importance of a therapist listening to the person to pick up where their pain might derive from and some of the extra complications that might come with it. And then, of course, the therapy approach will look very differently according to the circumstances around it.
And so what is maybe this slightly more holistic, maybe this slightly more enlightened way of looking at things? What is this, new way of approaching therapy interventions?
Okay, and look, in a sense of a new way, I think it's what most experienced therapists do, even if they have a background in cognitive behavioural therapy, or they might have been trained in psychodynamic therapy or some kind of psychodrama or chair work or action-based techniques. When it boils down to it, there are three different areas that we might focus on in a therapy approach, and that's what I thought that these people presented very well in this workshop, isolating these three areas that interestingly overlap with change processes in evolution. So it's about change and the nature of change. First of all, there needs to be some kind of variation. In other words, doing something different. When people come in for therapy, for whatever reason, often they're feeling somewhat stuck. And certainly if people have symptoms to do with it, distress, they're feeling low in mood or feeling very anxious or not so hopeful about the future or fearful of the future, often people are feeling a bit stuck, so there needs to be variation. And we'll talk later on about then how do the therapist and client go about looking for some kind of change, some kind of variation, what might that look like? Then the idea is, how do you then select or focus in on what you will look to change and how. In other words, how will you choose your interventions, or how will you choose your targets, or how will you decide what you're going to focus on, what you're going to do first, what you're going to spend the most time on trying to bring about that change or variation. So it's the selection stage. And then the third thing is, just say if people do find they're going in a direction that's working for them, they might be, again, feeling a lot more confident about how they're approaching a conflict situation. They might be feeling that their social life is more rewarding. They might be getting an easing of distress. They're feeling less anxious in certain situations. Now, this is all encouraging, but as many people would know who've been clients in a therapy situation, it's also about keeping it going. How do you keep it going? And that's the consolidation stage, or in evolution, I might talk about it as retention. How do you retain these adaptive changes? Or in other words, how do you consolidate the change? How do you keep it going?
And it is so interesting when you do compare it to evolution, like the evolutionary process. Like if you think of, you know, genes mutating, that's almost like variation. And then there's going to be some sort of selective adaptation for the ones that are most suited to the environment. And then the kind of retention consolidation is, you probably don't want to get into that too much, but you pass it off to your offspring in terms of the process continues.
Yes, I suppose that they call it there the survival of the fittest.
Yeah.
But it's all how you keep that adaptive change going. Pick the things that are working for you, keep them going.
And it just strikes me that I suppose maybe a way of thinking about this, which could be helpful, is it's almost like we're selectively breeding our habits in a way. Like, it strikes me there could be an element of trial and error that comes into this, in terms of if we kind of look at things in these broad terms, well, variation, that can lead us in so many different directions. It's just really about trying something new, mixing things up a little bit to try and sort of, I suppose, yeah, get unstuck in a particular way. And then that might either work or it might not work. And we can either sort of lean into some of those variations which are working for us, or we can put some on the, you know, the didn't work pile, and that's all right. Still good to try things that don't work and maybe get a sense of, well, paths that we don't necessarily want to go down with our routines as well. So, yeah, I just find it very interesting when you line it up to this kind of evolutionary process. We can almost think about it in terms of, well, I'm going to evolve as a person, and I have a bit of control over, I suppose, my kind of activities and behaviours. And so it's about, yeah, maybe introducing a few different ones into your routines and then choosing which ones of those are working for you.
I think that's a very good point that you're making also about the trial and error idea. And so there's something about that notion of trial and error. It can sound fairly imprecise. And I think it's quite different, especially in the early days of, say, cognitive behaviour therapy, and people are looking to do these randomised controlled trials and see what's the best intervention for this form of anxiety. Now, that's relevant. It's relevant to look at what might be certain kind of interventions that seem to work more broadly, better for more people than some other intervention, or, say, no treatment whatsoever, or just being on a waiting list. That's a really useful thing to do. But it can be overly prescriptive, because if someone were to say, look, we've done these randomised controlled trials, we know the gold standard treatment for this form of anxiety or panic. And you should be doing that. If you're not doing that, you're not doing the right kind of thing. There's almost that kind of implication to it, because it's scientific. We've done these studies. Yes, but what if the person's also dealing with a recent loss, where they're grieving, where they're not quite ready to focus on that particular way of addressing their panic? Or what if they face some ongoing threat, like they're virtually in some kind of war with their neighbours and they're feeling nervous every day about things that are happening that way? Like, we need to look at a wider context rather than just think, oh, this scientific study says this particular method or intervention is the way to go. Forget everything else in your life. We'll just focus on that. Now, it's looking at the broader picture. And as you say, sometimes it will be trial and error. And sometimes some of the best things that we come up with in therapy, the client, the therapist together, what we might work out, it might have started off as just a bit of left field idea, or let's just try this, or you might be more ready to have a go at this. How about we look at that first? It can be more imprecise, and that's okay.
And there's a massive part of this process as well where I reckon depending on obviously what the change is, like everyone's going to be a little bit different, but I suppose that kind of gets to the point of what this is. But like when we make a change for ourselves, like when we go through that element of variation with our routines, like I'm reminded of the fella that's come up on the podcast before about, for example, he was, you know, having a really tough time and he decided all he would do was walk to his dam every day on his property.
Yes, good example, yes.
And say, you know, at least I did that. And it was almost like the process of walking to his dam, like it's a small act, but that was able to change a few other things for him because he almost had this sense of control that he got from just doing that kind of one little thing. And I suppose it's now that I even really think about it, like that's a great example, because if we were being, for example, prescriptive about, you know, someone's got depression, someone's got maybe a whole range of issues, well, something like that could seem quite futile in terms of, you know, the grand scheme of options that we have to treat someone. Doing something is kind of simple as you know, every day making the effort to walk to your dam, like you might think, oh, hold on, you know, we need to come in with something a little bit more kind of tried and true here, something with maybe a little bit more grunt in a particular situation. But it just strikes me that such a big part of this is almost having the experience that I decided to change that one thing that I had control over, and I'm starting to get benefit from that. And then that almost opens up all these kind of extra possibilities for you, because you just have this almost tangible sense that you can change things and it's going to lead to benefit.
Yes, that's an important thing, and that's a very good example. That fellow who really did so well in the long run, starting with such a seemingly small change, walking maybe a couple of hundred metres. But that reminds me actually of something. Many years ago, I heard something that I thought was so wise. It was someone saying about how a therapist could be an effective behaviour change agent. So this is going back decades in the days of behaviour therapy where people would use terms like behaviour change agent or whatever. But he talked about a number of indicators or signs of someone being an effective therapist. And one that always stuck with me is when the therapist was able to notice some micro changes in the right direction, even noticing little changes in a certain direction. And I noticed that that's a basis of a form of therapy called motivational interviewing. There's lots of different elements of motivational interviewing. And one thing that really stuck with me in a workshop with William Miller, one of the pioneers of a motivational interviewing approach, is he would have us as therapists watch a video of someone talking about a particular problem, like in this case it was their alcohol use. And he'd have us indicate by tapping on our knees if we heard some kind of change talk or saw some gesture or response from the person that looked like they were showing some kind of readiness for change. And I noticed that through us in the audience, people at different levels would pick up on something that sounded a little bit encouraging. And if it was just a little bit of change talk or just something fairly mild, people would tap lightly on their knees. If someone said something really major, like I've already taken the step of, you know, having one alcohol-free day a week or something like that, then people would of course respond more. That's obvious a change is happening. But it's all oriented to helping the therapist to notice the small changes or significant changes that were already happening in the client. And that's a nice example of a collaboration, because there will be variation that comes up in what the person's doing or trying to do when they're looking to address a problem. And so it's not always up to the therapist to come up with every possible answer or direction how to go about that. Sometimes it's noticing the resource or the direction that's already there.
Well, let's get maybe into these ideas of variation, selection and consolidation, because I think it could help to maybe look at them a little bit closer, because just as we're speaking about this, for example, it comes across to me as a very simple idea in many ways. And I think maybe even intuitively, like people who are going through mental health challenges, like people often pick up on this idea of, you know, even, you know, introducing some more exercise into your routine. Like there's ways that people kind of vary their own routines that maybe doesn't always work. Like it strikes me that it's maybe not anything goes in this situation, in terms of it's not just about completely, you know, flipping life on its head and behaving. Oh, I think there was that Seinfeld episode where George decided to do the opposite of everything that that he intuitively thought to do. It strikes me that maybe that's not necessarily what we're saying. So if we have a look at, say, the variation side of things, I believe there was maybe a couple of questions that could come up in therapy which helped to, I suppose, maybe induce a bit of a sense of how people could vary their own behaviours and activities. What were those couple of questions?
Okay, and leading into those specific questions, yes, when we look at variation, a lot of that is about the person preparing for change and as a therapist helping the client prepare for change. And this relates to a point made by Milton Erickson, a very masterful kind of therapist. And he had a seemingly very insightful message that I heard another very experienced, masterful therapist describe recently. We did a video training, and this other therapist who's very famous for using hypnosis for depression, Michael Yapko, was talking about one of the main things he learned from Milton Erickson. And when Michael Yapko, decades ago, was a student of Erickson's, he asked him, "What do you think would be the main cause of psychological problems, of any kind of mental health problems?" And apparently Erickson answered in one word: rigidity. And that's a main theme from this podcast today, that if we're experiencing prolonged distress, if it's affecting our functioning in some ways, it might be our work or family or social roles in life, not getting so much enjoyment in life, then probably there's this element of stuckness that might go to our behaviours or routines or habits being a bit stuck, a bit rigid, or our thinking getting stuck on being a bit rigid, our ways of going about things generally, and maybe getting more of a narrowed focus, maybe being distracted by our difficulties and finding it hard to see a bigger picture of how things might be different. And so given that often people start with rigidity, then some of the most useful things that a therapist can ask early are questions that prepare for change. One of the main ones is what we describe is just about always our first question at this practice. The start of a therapy session, the first therapy session, we will typically ask the client, "What are your hopes from seeing me?" Because just even responding to that, having to think about what your hopes might be, even acknowledging that you can have hopes, that's encouraging some kind of change. It's different from what might have been a more traditional question of, "What are your problems?" or "What difficulties are you seeing me for?" People can talk about their problems and difficulties. Nothing much might be changing. But if you talk about your hopes, that's implying some kind of shift. A follow-up to that can even be asking someone, "How would you know if following therapy, you are successful in reaching your goals or getting what you hope from therapy? What would that look like?" The person might say, "Oh, I'd be socialising more, or I'd maybe be smiling more in this situation, or laughing more frequently, or I'd be doing that thing that I've meant to do for a long period of time, and I'll get around to actually organising that, or when I feel this particular way, that I'd be confident that, you know, within an hour or two, I would have found a way around that and not got too stuck with that." So just even the person thinking of what it would look like, what is the change that they would desire, if you like, and making that a bit more specific in describing it, that can be a useful thing to do. And I can describe a couple of others shortly.
Well, yeah, I think it's, it strikes me as something that would be very useful to do. But it was very interesting what you said about Milton Erickson and how he spoke about rigidity. Like, it reminds me so much of Albert Ellis and what he used to say about, like, must and should, about these kind of rigid ideas and how we can get into trouble with them. But it struck me as we were talking then, like, I just find this so interesting in some ways when you, for example, consider this idea of how it relates to evolution, for example. And, like, you talk about how this idea of being stuck and, you know, rigidity can develop. And, like, it strikes me that's such a natural process, but it makes sense in terms of what we're talking about, because, like, people are going to adapt to particular situations regardless. And I suppose what we're talking about with this variation side of things is we're looking for people to have productive adaptations as opposed to, do they call them maladaptive responses? Or you want to be kind of adaptive in a positive way rather than, I think they call it maladaptive, or have these kind of negative adaptations. And like, for example, it just strikes me that someone who has social anxiety, like they could adapt in a way, like their variation could be, I'm not going to go out in this situation, or I'm going to stay home, you know, at this particular time. And it just strikes me that like we're going to have this kind of variation, you know, ourselves, regardless of what we do, regardless of even whether we're going through mental health difficulties or not. Like there's elements of sort of evolution in our lives that kind of happen regardless, but it's almost about more getting on the front foot and kind of looking at it in a way of going, well, I don't necessarily want to just kind of fall into patterns or kind of fall into traps that people would often fall into when they are experiencing similar difficulties. It's almost about looking and going, well, hold on, what are the things that I can change that might lead to a slightly better outcome for me, rather than just kind of falling into these patterns, which naturally do come up and they're almost part and parcel of going through some of these challenges. But it strikes me that, yeah, it's almost looking at how can you work with a therapist, even of your own accord, how can you almost approach things in a way that's going to allow for maybe slightly more novelty, allow for a new way of looking at things and going about things that's going to maybe lead you past a bit of that stuckness.
Yes, and like you're saying, the person is likely to naturally experience some change themselves even before being in a therapy session. And that's where, you know, getting back to some of the questions that can be helpful to bring that out, you know, what you're describing, how there can be that sort of natural change, how you look at the more adaptive situations. One of the main things to consider early on, say in a therapy context, is to discuss what the person's tried in the past to deal with their distress in that situation, or feeling stuck in that work role, or tending to get burnt out frequently to the point where they're not enjoying their job so much, or things like that. Difficulties parenting children, difficulties in a relationship, or try to deal with conflict situations. So looking at what has the person done in the past, because at times people have had some previous course of therapy even, and some parts of that might have worked quite well, other parts not quite so well. And so it could be noticing the difference in those patterns, because that can give clues as to what might be worth building upon. And another thing is just looking generally, even if people haven't particularly tried things in the past to address a problem, is looking at when is a problem better and when is it worse. Like the person might think, oh, this problem with, for example, my tension headaches, it happens mainly in a certain kind of work situation. Or maybe I feel more nervous and distressed in certain social situations, especially if they're more than a certain number of people, or especially if I'm put on the spot in some way, or maybe when I'm meant to perform more, or things like that. So just noticing when problems are better and when they're worse, that actually gives clues about how the person might go about something differently as well.
And I'll be keen to hear it. I know you've got a few stories that maybe illustrate this next point, and I'll be interested to hear a couple of those in just a moment. But it strikes me that, for example, sometimes things maybe need to come out of left field a little bit. Like we spoke about the gentleman who walked to his dam, like what could potentially seem like a slightly trivial exercise in some ways, but that was almost the unlock for him. And came across this book a couple of years ago, which it's just one of my favorite books. It's called The Creative Curve by Alan Gannett. And it talks about all these kind of creative people in society, like the Beatles, and people who've put out this, what's recognized to be kind of edgy, sort of new, you know, moving sort of things in a particular direction in any sort of creative field. But he spoke about the balance, for example, between novelty and familiarity. And it's almost like, well, you need enough familiarity that people kind of will recognize something, they can almost classify it for themselves, but then you actually need enough novelty where people go, oh, this is, you know, really new and it's moving things in a new direction, and I'm interested by almost like the way that this is new compared to things that are familiar for me in the past. And I wonder if there's almost a sense that we can kind of look at, say, novelty and familiarity And we want sort of variation that is kind of a bit novel. It's going to help us kind of move in a new direction and maybe get a little bit unstuck because it's something that we haven't tried before. But we also want there to be an element of familiarity with it as well. Like, we don't necessarily want to just do something completely new that we've never sort of resonated with before. It is almost looking at things and thinking, well, hold on, you know, what's going to work for me? Even if it's something that, you know, I haven't necessarily done before, it is moving in a slightly new direction. Well, if we just think, what's kind of the opposite of, you know, what I've been doing? Like, that's maybe not getting to the heart of it. So I suppose, yeah, what are some of those stories that maybe highlighted that point about, well, particularly how novelty can really help in terms of some of these interventions? And yeah, what are your thoughts on maybe how, say, novelty and familiarity can almost be a bit of a guide to some of the interventions that are going to work for us?
Okay, so it's going to be what the person's ready to respond to is part of it. But also, I think, like you say, unless something comes across a bit different to what people have encountered before, something a little bit unexpected, a little bit different, that's where I find as a therapist, I hope that there are ways can give messages to people, if you like, or suggestions that come across as a little bit novel or different. And look, it might be that we're discussing it with a degree of humour. Or it could be storytelling, you know, telling of other people's experiences that the person might be a bit interested in because it relates to them and they might not have heard stories like that before because, for example, I've heard them in confidence, don't need to disclose anything about a person's identity, but you can say, well, there was this other person who experienced such and such, and that's often engaging to people because they mightn't have heard stories like that before. But one thing I'll mention that I think is an example that works quite well with novelty, but it can help people stretch people in a certain way. They might accept it. At times, people might be seeing a therapist and they feel they're revealing some certain shameful things about themselves. It might even be that the person's been experiencing suicidal thoughts, which in itself is not so unusual. If people are feeling stuck, it doesn't mean that needs to be a terrible sign about someone's mental health. If people have been suffering with certain kinds of distress for a period of time, they're feeling stuck, they can't see a way themselves of improving it much at the time, then it's almost logical that the person would have some thoughts go through their mind, gee, if I felt like this forever, then, geez, life would be barely worth living and might have some suicidal thoughts following on from that. It might be at least a quarter of the people we see in our practice, I think probably a little bit more the first time, who would have had some kind of suicidal thoughts. It just basically is saying at a most basic level, hey, I really don't like living like this. I'm not getting much joy out of life. But the thing is, it doesn't have to stay stuck like that, even in very dire situations or what might seem like dire situations. There are virtually always ways that things can improve, and especially if people have been depressed and have that negative slant on themselves and things that happen in future. So what can be disarming to people if they acknowledge this, for example, it might be a shameful feeling, I've been having suicidal thoughts or, you know, thoughts of harming themselves. If the therapist introduces a discussion about self-compassion, or helping the person see how they might be being quite hard on themselves, that in fact, that many people might experience some similar kinds of distress to what they do. Many other people might have some similar kind of negative thoughts or find it hard to see a positive future, even have some kind of suicidal thoughts. And that doesn't mean anything necessarily terrible about them or has to point to a dark kind of future. A lot of it can be that the person feels stuck at the time. And if people are going to be very hard on themselves about that, it's going to be harder to become unstuck. So that's where even the whole approach of the therapist with a client being accepting and interested and being able to maybe show some kind of understanding, empathising, recognising where the person's coming from, maybe anticipating some other reactions that they might have that they might not even have expressed fully. If the person feels a little bit more understood and accepted in that situation, that can be different. And I'll mention going back to many years ago when I was very severely depressed and seeing a therapist, when that person got it, how distressed and despairing I felt, and yet they seemed still very much themselves and intact and treating me like a decent person and clearly they had some notions that I might have a decent kind of future. That was a shift for me. That was novelty in itself to encounter that, and started me thinking a little bit more of potential for change. So that in itself can be a kind of novelty if the person can maybe say more of their darker kind of experience and yet be sitting in front of a therapist who's kind of hopeful in a way. That's potentially a shift in itself and leads to the person maybe starting to question more whether their perception of themselves has been balanced or fair or whatever. I'll give some more striking examples of novelty shortly.
Well, let's get into maybe what some of those examples are. Like, I know Milton Erickson himself had a very interesting novel approach to introducing some variation into someone's routine.
Yes, he's one of the people who came up with an idea of, we call it prescribing the symptom. And so one example of how that could be used is the person says, oh, look, I'm really having problems with my sleep. I wake up during the night and I can't get back to sleep and it's a real problem. I'm not functioning well the next day. What prescribing the symptom might do is, rather than looking at the person trying to get back to sleep, the therapist might ask the person, there's something I'm going to ask you to do. What I'm going to ask you to do is to try to stay awake for the whole night, not get back to sleep, and then see how that goes. Now, that's an oversimplified way of putting it, but there's a lot of novelty there. It's the exact opposite of what the person would be expecting. Hey, staying awake all night, that's my problem. But in fact, there's some situations where prescribing the symptom can lead to that variation. Rather than the person lying awake thinking of what a problem it is, they would actually likely find several times during the night when there's that, through ultradian rhythms, there's a period of extra sleepiness, that it's really hard for them to actually try and stay conscious. And very often the person would fall asleep at some stage during the night, having thought that they'd stay awake all night and that wouldn't be difficult, and that can shift their view of whether they don't get a wink of sleep or they can't sleep at all. So that's just an example of turning it on its head. But I'll give another example, and the reason I'll give this example is it was of a very experienced therapist who was maybe almost a bit coy or almost a bit embarrassed about telling me and another friend, another psychologist, this story, because it might seem too wacky. But it's a fantastic example of introducing novelty. She was seeing a young woman with bulimia. And when that young woman had different kind of, you know, binges with certain food, it might include cream cakes and other kind of cakes, things like that. Other kind of foods as well. And the therapist got this intuitive image that seemed completely wacky. It was certainly novel. She asked the client, she said, look, I'm going to ask you to do something. Might sound a bit strange, but what I want you to do is to get all those foods that you tend to binge on, like the cream buns and things like that. I want you to fill a bath. Then I want you to get in the bath. And then I want you to throw all that food in around you. What a bizarre image. Anyway, the young woman did that. Got a bath, threw in the cream buns and all the rest of it. It led to a real shift in her bulimic behaviour, the binges and all the rest of it. And you stop and you look back, and rather than it being a crazy idea, which on the face of it would seem that, there were some ways it actually shifted or changed the young woman's relationship to food, rather than seeing it as, I suppose, this food is having a kind of power over her, like she couldn't control that or whatever. She saw it in quite a different way when she saw these cream buns and that floating around in the bathtub. So there was a lot more to the therapy, as you can imagine, than just that. But I really admired that therapist for being prepared to do something different and so out of left field. The fact that it worked is wonderful. But again, she was acting on a deeper kind of intuition that tapped into a real creativity and novelty that, wow, talk about trial and error. That could have been hit and miss. It could have been a real miss. In that case, it was a hit. But I mentioned that just as an example. That gave me license as a young therapist to think, be prepared sometimes to be a bit bold and do something a bit different, even if it might seem it'd be crazy if you described it to someone else.
And I suppose that gets to almost the heart of this idea that it's like it seems so much to me that like this idea of variation is about breaking up patterns that might have become a little bit more rigid and we're not able to necessarily get past them in a particular way. We might be avoidant, and so we're therefore likely to slip into certain patterns, or yeah, even things like PTSD and this sort of thing. Like, you can see how these kind of patterns develop. And to me, that in some ways idea of the food in the bathtub, like that almost resonates a little bit more in terms of the variation, because I suppose you can almost look at it in terms of, oh, okay, I'll get up, you know, 15 minutes earlier in the morning and go for a walk every day and things like this. Like, they are kind of tried and true measures, but it just shows that you can almost look at things and go, well, just what do I need to do to just break up this kind of rigid way that I'm looking at it? And doing something like that, it strikes me as, yeah, it seems absolutely bizarre on the surface, but it's just a kind of good, novel way to just break up this pattern of rigidity.
Yes, and I'd sort of mention that here's an example more to be a bit open-minded about different ways of looking at things as this overall approach we're talking about today, it relates to that theme. But look, the truth is most forms of therapy will have a little bit more of an informed idea. Well, the therapist will have a bit of an informed idea of what kind of variations often tend to help. For example, many anxiety disorders, like certainly phobias, when people suffer from panic attacks and agoraphobia, so they might not go to the supermarket, or people avoiding certain social situations or avoiding expressing their thoughts on situations or not going for job interviews related to certain kind of avoidant tendencies, then therapists will be aware of ways of helping, nudging people, even pushing them a bit, even helping people themselves push themselves to go out of the comfort zone. We know that's often the main variation that's called for with a whole range of anxiety-based reactions, especially when there's phobic anxiety or exaggerated fear attached to it. Basically, the main changes often involve going outside your comfort zone. When people have avoidant personality patterns, then it's not just the challenge of going out of the comfort zone, it's also giving yourself a pat on the back. That's hard for people to do at first. That's a variation that's very hard for many people to do when they're suffering from social anxiety combined with a self-criticism. And so it's important to, again, come in with some of that self-compassion, but specifically to be able to find ways of giving oneself a pat on the back. Or another example for PTSD, when someone's having flashbacks and nightmares and they react very strongly, if they've had a car accident, to seeing a movie, if there's a car accident depicted in the movie, then often we know that one of the variations that people might need to do is to go through some kind of reliving of that trauma experience whilst setting up certain things in the therapy setting to be able to help the person have a different kind of reaction, to help, in other words, bring their arousal level down and to see things differently. And that's where we might use therapy techniques like EMDR that we've talked about in previous podcasts. So also with depression, we know that one of the variations is likely to be to help the person increase their activity level, because often people are stuck with a lower level of activity, and often one of the variations might be looking to shift certain patterns of thinking or thoughts in a certain direction. So there are, dare I say, some more predictable areas which might help for a little bit more efficiency and effectiveness of people getting variation. So a lot of the things we talked about earlier is what the client can bring to considering what they might vary, or how things have been different, or when they're better and when they're worse, or what they've tried before. But look, very often in therapy, there are some more tried and true patterns as go-to patterns or therapy interventions that still there's a bit of trial and error in that as well. But what we're talking about now is still drawing on that kind of knowledge or experience and other people's stories of what they've found helpful, but to do it with a flexible attitude.
We better get on to selection and consolidation. Like, I think variation is really going to be the kind of meat and potatoes of this topic. But if we look at selection, it seems to me that maybe selection's about looking at what kind of works for us, what's meaningful for us, and then almost leaning into those kind of variations that are working in that sense or resonating with us. Is it as simple as that, looking at what's, say, meaningful and working for us and then almost, yeah, leaning into that side of things, or is it a little bit more complicated than that?
Look, I think there are ways of simplifying it, but I think the first thing is when client and therapist meet is looking at what most stands out in terms of the person's distress. So again, when people trained in, say, clinical psychology at first or come out and graduate and they're looking to be effective therapists and diagnose accurately and then use good therapy interventions, people might think, oh, look, I know this person has panic attacks and that's a key thing that they've looked for help with. But also they're describing a whole lot of things coming up in terms of conflict with their partner. And it turns out maybe with some other people as well. So we're not getting around to addressing the panic attacks because these other themes are coming up. Well, I think often good therapy is noticing what are the main things standing out at first? Where is the most pain for the person coming from? What might be the biggest thorn in their side, if you like? So a lot of that's from listening. The person being able to talk off the top of their head, the therapist listening and noticing that, because sometimes that can suggest certain kind of changes or ways of going about things, even apart from usual or typical therapy approaches. It might be addressing some kind of worry they have. There might be something productive they can do about a particular conflict or concern about their work or something like that. So part of that might be looking at an initial problem-solving technique to deal with that. Before getting on to, for example, addressing panic or even other things to address depression, for example. But we can also look at what the person is most ready to change. Sometimes it's a bridge too far for a person with maybe a number of phobias, including a driving phobia, to drive to Melbourne and back, for example. So you don't have to tackle the biggest challenges first. You can look at what the person's more ready to do. The person might also feel some level of anxiety in certain social situations with friends. It might be a matter of you start there so the person gets a little bit more confidence of facing some kind of anxiety in any situation before you lead on to the most challenging kind of problem. So the point of this is, I think, rather than the client just passively looking at what the therapist might suggest and the therapist rigidly thinking, oh, look, you've got these symptoms, that means that we should be using this therapy approach, there's a collaboration between the client and the therapist, and a lot of it is the therapist listening to the client in terms of where their pain lies, some things they've done to address that in the past, any early green shoots of change, including little hints of directions that the person's going in. But even before looking at just launching into some kind of therapy approach like CBT or chair work or something like that, often it helps to really hear out the different things that a client is inclined to say early in a session, because anything that people bring up in that situation, it's not going to be irrelevant. There's usually going to be some clue or theme if the person's using that early time when they've got a chance to express anything. It's usually going to be some real value in paying attention to what the person brings up rather than just launching into some other therapy approach straight off.
And so, yeah, you said it there, but it seems to me that that selective element is just so much about the relationship between the therapist and the client, the collaboration that they're prepared to have, and even maybe the openness from both of them to, if maybe things aren't working or things could do with maybe a shift in a particular direction, to then, yeah, to both be kind of happy to do that when it's appropriate.
Yes, and I think one of the main things we're looking at here with selecting what to focus on is, I think it really helps to recognise that a lot of answers or clues Certainly clues, if not full answers, will come from the client. And once I heard a psychiatrist describe that in therapy, he thought something that was very helpful was the therapist to respond with a lubricative grunt, meaning just some kind of expression or look or reaction that encourages the person to keep on talking. Because when someone's in a therapy setting and they're talking off the top of their head, but about something meaningful to them or something that's coming from them, there's usually more than a clue in that of what direction to proceed. So it really helps to have some, I think, unstructured time where the person can say something about how they're feeling in certain situations or reacting in certain situations, because I think there are clues from within about what the person could do with. And the cartoonist Michael Loenig conveyed some of that in a cartoon. Had this character walking along a path, and it was actually meant to represent or be a metaphor for psychotherapy. This fellow's walking along and he's got this funny lid on his head, and this lid on the top of his head has opened up, and there's this roll of carpet coming out of the top of his head and rolling down the carpet, then comes under his feet, and he walks on this roll of carpet that's come out from his head in front of him, down under his feet. So it's almost like this circular loop. He's letting things out of his head that he's walking on, and the caption was, "Let it out, let it out, let it all unravel. And from your mind, you will find a path on which to travel." Now that's more the psychodynamic idea of allowing space for the person to express themselves, step back from their reactions. People can hear themselves talking as well. The therapist looks to pick up clues also and nuances in what the person's saying, and that sometimes can lead to other hints and suggestions forward about maybe circumstances from the past that have influenced people's reactions, or what is a current pain that the person might not have fully recognized, or a yearning or hope they have in some kind of direction or something relevant to their identity or where they get meaning in life. So as far as those things goes, I think it's good to have some unstructured time, as well as the truth is a lot of therapy will also involve the therapist drawing on techniques or strategies they're familiar with that might help address certain kinds of pain or difficulty or distress the person's experiencing. But again, when that part of the conversation or the process comes in, it really helps if that's very collaborative and the person can convey how that seems to fit for them and suit them. And remembering, as you said earlier, we're always using things in a somewhat trial and error manner.
And consolidation, so like the final step in the process, it seems to me is a little bit about, I suppose, moving a little bit more towards these kind of adaptive strategies as opposed to the maladaptive patterns that we're more likely to, I suppose, maybe naturally fall into without the support that we gain in therapy. Like a lot of these mental health difficulties, a lot of the challenge is from falling into these kind of maladaptive patterns. So do you want to just speak to the idea of consolidation and how that can come up?
Okay, now again, key thing, how the client can contribute to that as well as the therapist. Now, certainly from the client's point of view, part of it is appreciating the change and giving oneself credit for the change. And this is where it really helps when therapy is an active process, when the client is actively involved. They might have revised what their hopes are. We don't assume that what people say at the start of therapy, oh, my hope is this, that that's going to end up what their hopes are. Their hopes might continually evolve or shift at different times, and that's fine. But it really helps for the person to notice and appreciate the changes that they've made and then look at some ways of keeping them going. There are some strategies that might help with that. The first thing is recognizing that change or looking to address some kind of difficulty is not just feeling that you've reached a point where that problem is no longer impacting you at the time. It's also keeping that going. It is the maintenance, that consolidation. And so how do you do that? Sometimes it helps to keep on monitoring in some way what change people are making. And that monitoring can almost be in the form of like checking in with a friend, letting someone know or a partner know that you want to continue going in a certain direction. Most obviously, if someone's looking at, say, smoking cessation or addressing an addiction like alcohol use or whatever, that's the whole idea of things like Alcoholics Anonymous. People might go for 20 years afterwards, even after they've not had a drink anymore, but to help maintain certain changes, especially if they've had a severe problem with alcohol dependence in the past. But in a more minor way, it can just be letting a trusted friend or a partner know about a change that you want to keep on going with. It also includes maybe having one or two follow-up sessions with a therapist, I think is always worthwhile, even if someone's really addressed a problem well, like depression or dealing with panic in certain ways. I think those follow-up sessions, it might be a month later and then maybe 3 months down the track, to help see that changes are being maintained. I think that's a useful kind of thing to do. But in other ways, if the person rewards themselves in some fashion, it might be even saying to themselves, look, if I keep on going in this kind of direction, then I really will make sure that I plan that holiday or do such and such. Just different ways of being able to appreciate the positive efforts that you've made and the person remembering that they're the one who's made the change. They might have benefited from a therapy process, but noticing the things that they've actively done to help themselves to look to keep on with those things in future.
And I suppose that the key point that stands out to me there is, like, how can someone reward themselves to keep going? Like, I wouldn't have necessarily almost included that word reward if I was, you know, initially looking at it, not having had a bit of a chat to you about it. But I think if we can just think of it in the context of, well, how can I reward myself to keep going? Well, that probably takes care of half of the consolidation in itself, because we're looking at things in terms of, you know, they're a positive activity that we really enjoy doing. Like, if you're thinking of it in terms of, well, what do I need to do to stave off depression, for example, well, then you sort of think, oh, geez, you know, I've got this kind of this looming depression that, you know, if I don't do these things, it's going to, you know, crush me and fall down upon me. That's such a different context to look at it in compared to, well, if I was to look at, you know, my great days, what are maybe some things that they all include? Or, you know, if I was to, yeah, maybe have a day where I, you know, I just do these few things, then I can at least say, to me, that was a good day. I've ticked all the boxes that I can kind of practically tick in a day for myself. Yeah, it just seems to me that that idea of how can we reward ourselves is going to really make things easier than, well, what do I need to do to maintain my wellness, or what do I need to do to stave off depression?
Yes, that's a very good point. And to some extent, I suppose the reward notion comes from that earlier behavior therapy kind of approach where we look at, say, positive reinforcement or positive consequences for certain kind of behavior. But I like the way that you mentioned that it's really appreciating what works for you. And it also shows there's certain behaviors that we need to keep going or put some active effort into to be able to enjoy our lives more fully and find more balance that way. And I think that alludes to many things that have come up in the field of positive psychology. And it reminds me what you've said there too. Late in therapy, when we find that people have maybe made quite a degree of progress with certain anxiety problems or depression or trauma reactions, we often then bring in more positive psychology kind of approaches. So gratitude, when people are appreciating good things happening in their day, self-compassion, people being forgiving of themselves in certain ways, character strengths, people recognising some of the best in themselves, having some of that kind of positive focus can help. But really partly what we're talking about here too is mindfulness or awareness of what works for you. Just people appreciating and noticing the positive differences that have come from their efforts and not forgetting that, but continuing to recognise that in some way. That's the main kind of reinforcing reward that's likely to help things keeping on going. Noticing how the efforts that you've already made, how they've made a difference, and having some practical ways that you've considered to keep them going.
And I'm sure there'd be a whole bunch of brain science around, whether it be dopamine and serotonin and these kind of neurotransmitters that that will help us consolidate this stuff and maybe looking at things in those terms that you've described there maybe helps to leverage those kind of positive neurotransmitters as much as possible. So, well, thanks for chatting with me about all this today, Dad. It's been an interesting topic and I suppose, in some ways builds upon what we've spoken about with meaning and with a range of other episodes where maybe this idea of the medical model and just having an external fix for things isn't probably going to get to the heart of things, maybe as much as individualizing things a little bit more and looking at what's going to work for us and maybe our specific set of circumstances. So thanks for chatting with me about all this today. I look forward to the next one.
Same here, Rowan, and I hope that any people experiencing therapy or who have experienced therapy can notice things that have come up in that were quite individualized and flexible, where they and the therapist worked out together a way of helping adapt things more to them and where they were at. It's a whole lot about that.